This is the Stella Culinary School Podcast, Episode 11, Sauce Bechamel. Podcast found online at stellaculinary.com. My name is Jacob. Thank you once again for joining me. Today we will be continuing our five-part series on the mother sauces, talking a little bit about sauce bechamel, which is a milk-based sauce that's thickened with starch, most commonly a roux. But before we talk about that, I want to continue our discussion in the discussion segment on starch as thickeners, and kind of continue the whole theme of thickening agents for your sauces and soups. And then stay tuned for the culinary quick tip. Right at the end of the show, we're talking about how to use that sauce bechamel to make a nice version of homemade mac and cheese. And also, I have a really interesting listener question from Luke asking about basically the acid egg yolk paradox. So stay tuned for that. All right, so in today's discussion segment, before we get into actually how to make sauce bechamel, I want to talk a little bit more about our thickening agents that are used to thicken sauces. And today we're going to have more of an in-depth discussion on starches, and starches more specifically as thickeners. So what is a starch? And understanding sort of how a starch is made up is going to affect how you thicken your sauces and what kind of thickening agent and starch-based thickening agent you will use. Now, a starch is basically thousands and thousands of glucose molecules that are linked up in a long chain. Now, there are two predominant shapes that this chain will take, and this has a direct effect on how that particular starch molecule is going to thicken a liquid. So the first of the two is a starch chain called amylopectin, and it's basically a short-branched glucose chain with kind of like, you know, things kind of sticking out from the sides. And the second one is called amylose, which is a long straight chain of glucose. Now, when the amylose is dissolved in water, it forms sort of like a helical shape, but it still remains fairly straight and elongated. Now, this makes it more likely that the long glucose chains will tangle with each other or just any particulate matter that's in your sauce. Now, it's for this reason that starches made up of predominantly amylose chains will accomplish the same thickening power as amylopectin chain, the shorter stubby chains, but with much less amylose-based starch required. Now, both cornstarch and wheat-based starches are predominantly made up of amylopectin, whereas potato starch contains a large amount of amylose and therefore has a much stronger thickening power. So you need less potato starch to thicken a given sauce than you would cornstarch or flour. Now, once you actually add your starch to your sauce, there is what's called a gelation point. Now, starch doesn't thicken in cold water, which is nice because it allows you to actually make a slurry by dispersing a given starch into a cold water and then adding that into a simmering stock or sauce, and then it will then, as it starts to come to temperature, it will thicken. Now, depending on the kind of starch used, at around 120 degrees Fahrenheit to 140 degrees Fahrenheit, which is about 50 to 60 degrees Celsius, the starch granules start to lose their organized structure and absorb a large amount of water and start to swell. The starch granules will continue to thicken as the temperature of the sauce and liquid rise, and the starch granules begin to burst, and they'll start leaking out more starches into the surrounding liquid. And this is that the point where the sauce reaches its full thickening potential. After that occurs, once the starch is thickened and reaches its full thickness with the starch added, it will start to thin and even out its consistency. And this is a good thing because what happens is when those starch granules start to swell in your sauce, it kind of gives you almost an uneven texture in that sauce. So that's why a lot of the times when people are talking about, you know, adding a roux or adding a starch-based thickening agent, they always want to, you know, they always instruct you to bring that sauce to a full boil while whisking. And basically what this does is that's, you know, one of the ways to actually, you know, thin the sauce is there. What basically happens is if you bring the sauce to a full boil, you whisk vigorously, or you slowly simmer the sauce over a long period of time, the swelled starch molecules will start to burst, and they're going to actually burst into a smaller particulate starches that are going to give your sauce a much more even consistency. Now, again, if you're reading some classic cookbooks, you'll notice that they'll usually call for a simmering time after adding the starch, which is usually around 20 minutes to an hour. Not only will this cook out the starchy flavor of the thickener, but it'll also burst the large swelling starch granules, giving you your sauce a better consistency. Now, after that occurs, you're basically going to have your sauce thickened and pretty much ready to go. But there's one more thing you need to take into consideration. As the sauce cools, the starch and water molecules will start to form temporary bonds that break apart less often because there's not that energy from the heat that's constantly breaking them apart. Now, this is why it's always important to judge your sauce, the consistency of your sauce, at its serving temperature. So most sauces are cooked and simmered at around 200 degrees Fahrenheit or 93 degrees Celsius or above, right? Because that's above the simmering temperature. But by the time the sauce hits the plate and makes it to the dinner table, it will most likely drop by 20 to 30 degrees. So if you want to check the consistency of your sauce, I would always highly recommend, you know, taking a spoonful out, laying it down on a room temperature plate, and seeing what the texture is of that sauce after it has about, you know, 60 seconds to 2 minutes to cool. And if you're happy with that sauce, then you can go ahead and begin thinking about serving it. Now, flour is a very commonly used thickening agent, and we already talked about roux. And again, the purpose of roux is to add some flavor and some color, and basically cook out the floury taste before it's even added to the sauce in the first place. But there's also a couple other things called a whitewash and beurre manier, which we're going to talk about in a second. But first, let's talk about actually, you know, what wheat flour is. And basically, wheat flour, it's only 75% starch and contains around 10% protein, and this protein is called gluten. Now, because wheat flour is not pure starch, it has less thickening ability than cornstarch, which is basically pure starch. Now, a general rule of thumb is that it takes about 1.5 times more wheat flour than cornstarch to achieve the same thickening results. And this is taking into consideration that you're not, you know, cooking a roux to a really darkened stage that loses more of its thickening power, but more just, you know, 1-to-1 if you're doing a side-by-side test, basically making a cold water slurry with cornstarch and a cold water slurry with wheat flour. And when I say wheat flour, I'm not talking whole wheat flour. I'm talking about, you know, all-purpose flour or bread flour. It's going to take 1.5 times more flour than cornstarch to get the same thickening results. Now, when using wheat flour as a thickener, the gluten proteins that we talked about in the flour will cloud the sauce and give it an opaque look with sort of a matte finish. It's not going to be, you know, shiny or clear. It's going to be more matte looking. Now, this can be reversed by simmering for hours and constantly skimming gluten in the form of scum that rises to the top. And this is why when, you know, next episode we're going to talk about sauce espagnole, which is thickened using flour. And the classic version done by Escoffier requires an extremely long simmering and skimming time. And this is one of the reasons. It's to remove the gluten proteins as they sort of bubble to the surface and form a scum. And you're going to skim those off. And it's going to give you a more favorable appearance to your sauce. Now, again, flour also make your sauce taste, well, like flour. right? So this is why it's usually cooked in the form of a roux, or again, it's going to be simmered for a long extended period of time to cook out the starchy flavor. And usually, from my experience, it takes about around 20 to 30 minutes if you're adding raw flour in the form of a slurry to a stock or a sauce. It's going to take about another 20 to 30 minutes after that addition to actually, simmer and basically cook out that floury flavor. So a whitewash is basically, it's kind of like a last-ditch effort. It's use a whitewash when you're in a rush and you didn't have time to make a roux, or maybe you made a roux already and you didn't make enough. And a whitewash is nothing more than a slurry of cold water and flour. And you add, in a one-to-one ratio of cold water and flour to a mixing bowl. And you basically whisk it together. And you want to whisk vigorously right before you add it to the sauce, because the heavy flour particles are going to basically, if you allow it to rest, are going to drop down to the bottom of the water. And so when you add it into your stock or your sauce, it's going to form clumps, right? So you want to whisk it vigorously, and once you've made a slurry, and if it looks a little too thick for you, you can always just thin it out, because again, that little extra touch of water is going to make your life a whole lot easier incorporating that slurry into your sauce, and it's only going to take you, a couple extra minutes to basically simmer out or reduce down that additional couple tablespoons of water that you added to your slurry. And what happens is it basically allows all of the starch change, or the glucose change, that are the starch molecules, to break apart and be separate. So when you add it to your sauce, it doesn't clump. Everyone remembers the clumpy gravy, right? Well, that happens because the starch molecules were not separated properly using a slurry or using fat such as in a roux. Now, another option is to separate those raw starch molecules in the flour by using what's called a beurre manier. And basically, that's just taking a one-to-one mixture by weight of butter and flour, and you knead it into like a loose paste or a dough. And what happens is during this kneading process, the fats, or the fat droplets of the butter, will kind of get in the way of the starches and separate them out, right? So when you go and you add this to your stock, when we're trying to thicken it for a soup or a sauce, then it's going to incorporate a lot more easily, and it's going to prevent clumping, all right? And the way that you would use a beurre manier is almost the same way that you would use a roux, but you're using it in its raw state. So it's not going to add that nutty flavor of a nice brown roux, and it's not going to add that color, but it's kind of another one of those last-ditch efforts where you can, knead it together, and you just break off little pieces of this flour and butter dough, and you drop it into your stock, you whisk constantly, bring it back up to a simmer, and then you check for sauce consistency, and you keep on doing this until you reach the proper thickening that you're looking for. Now, again, once you have reached that thickness, you're going to want to simmer for another, at least 20 minutes. So some of that fat that's going to that was incorporated in that beurre manier is going to break away, break out of the sauce. It's going to rise to the top. So you want to skim that fat, because you never want to have a fatty, broken sauce. And also, again, some of the gluten particles will rise to the top as part of, the scum that comes to the surface. And at that point, you can, if serving like an opaque sauce, when I say opaque, basically think of like a gravy, right? So a gravy is usually always opaque looking. So if you're making a gravy, or if you don't mind the look of a gravy on your plate, then it's fine. You want to just simmer for about, 20 to 30 minutes to remove that starchy flavor from the flour, and then you can serve it. But if the visual appeal is, you want it more refined, then you want to serve, basically you want to simmer it for a much longer time, 1 to 2 hours on a very low flame, skimming constantly, and go from there. But then again, if you're looking for sort of a finer consistency sauce, I would recommend what's called a full reduction, which is using the gelatin in the stock to actually thicken. But we're going to talk about that sort of modern take on sauce making in next episode. Now, the next two starches that I want to talk about are cornstarch and arrowroot. And again, these are just pure starch-based thickeners that can be used in a slurry form, just like we were talking about with the whitewash, that are going to allow you to thicken a sauce all minute. Now, the nice thing about both cornstarch and arrowroot is neither of them contain the gluten that is found in flour. So you'll notice a lot of Chinese dishes, a lot of their glazes that they use to glaze their meat. I mean, think like sweet and sour pork, even though I know that's kind of a bastardized version of a Chinese dish. But it's always that nice, shiny, glossy sort of sauce on there. That comes from using cornstarch as a thickener instead of flour. And so that's another way around. If you want more of a shiny consistency and you're looking to kind of thicken the sauce right at the last minute, then cornstarch or arrowroot is the way to go. And I always use cornstarch just because arrowroot is much more expensive, and I really don't find it adds any better quality to the sauce generally. Now, with all that said, I really wouldn't recommend either a beurre manier or a whitewash. Again, to me, that's a last-ditch effort to, where you didn't really plan your sauce making out properly. If you're going to be using flour for a thickening agent, I would always recommend using a roux, like we talked about in a previous episode, or I would recommend using what's called a farinier technique, which is basically dusting with flour during the cooking process. But we're actually going to touch on farinier in next episode. So in today's technique segment, now that we've gotten all the starch thickeners out of the way, we're going to talk about the next mother sauce in the lineup called bechamel. Now, bechamel is basically nothing more than a flavored milk that's thickened with a white roux. All right, and it's a very classic to be the base sauce for cream sauces or just any basically a white milk-based sauce is going to start with a roux. And then you add ingredients, and as you add different flavoring ingredients or you change up your technique here and there, you're going to end up with some secondary derivative sauces off of this one mother sauce. So it's really, really simple. What you want to do is you need 4 ounces of roux. Now, I'm going to give you this recipe. It's basically just a standardized classic recipe. And again, the bechamel is it's not very commonly used as itself. It's always doctored in some way or another to create a secondary sauce that has a little bit more oomph and a little more flavor. A true classic bechamel is kind of boring and bland, to be completely honest with you. But understanding it as a mother sauce and as a base sauce, it's going to allow you to, just by adding a few additional ingredients, make a really nice white sauce. So again, I'm going to give you a quick standardized recipe just to give you an idea of what goes into making a bechamel. And this recipe and all the derivatives can be found on stellaculinary.com in the episode 11 show notes. So don't worry too much about writing the stuff down. This information will be made available to you. But you're going to start with 4 ounces of white roux. So it's going to be 2 ounces of butter and 2 ounces of all-purpose flour. Now, classically, like we talked about before, you would use clarified butter to make your roux. You're going to need 1 quart of milk. Any milk will work, but a whole milk is preferable just because it contains more fat, and fat is yummy. You're going to need 1/4 of a white onion peeled, 1 whole clove, now not garlic clove, but actually the spice clove, 1 whole bay leaf, salt, white pepper, and nutmeg to taste. Now, all you're going to do is you're going to just start by making your white roux, just like we discussed in the previous episode. Now, in a separate pot, you want to heat your milk to just below the simmering point, and you want to add your roux to the heated milk and whisk constantly until your milk comes to a boil. You want to reduce the flame and basically set it at a gentle simmer that's stable. So, find that nice flame setting where it's, at a nice gentle simmer. And you want to take your 1/4 of an onion and you want to stick your bay leaf to it using the clove. And this isn't really going to affect the flavor. This is just going to make it easier to pull out later. And it's tradition. This is how it was made. Instead of just throwing the onion and the bay leaf and the clove in, you take the bay leaf and you stick it to onion with the clove. So it's just one of those classic dogma things. Now, place it in your simmering milk for about 30 minutes. And you're going to add more hot milk during the simmering process to adjust the consistency. So if it reduces too much and your sauce becomes too thick, you're going to want to add just a little bit more warm milk to even it out. Now you want to finish the sauce after that 30-minute time period by seasoning with salt, white pepper, and freshly ground nutmeg. Now the seasoning in this sauce should be subtle, and the spice is only there to add depth of flavor. You shouldn't be able to pick them out one by one, because again, this is a base sauce that you're later going to use to create secondary sauces that are more full-bodied and have a better flavor. Now, also, you always want to use this sort of caution when adding salt or white pepper to your base sauce recipe, okay? Because again, you're going to do a final seasoning during the secondary sauce phase. So don't go overboard. You want to, again, add salt and white pepper for depth of flavor. Now, this can very easily then be added or made into a standard cream sauce. And to make a standard cream sauce, which is a secondary sauce of bechamel, you want to add about 4 to 8 ounces of heavy cream, heated and tempered. That means you're kind of, you bring it up to just below a simmer, and then you add it in slowly to your milk. You want to add in salt and white pepper to taste, and then you can add from there any number of herbs and spices. You know, I'm a big fan of thyme and tarragon. You can add some parsley, whatever it is that you want to add in. If you're adding dry herbs, you want to add them in earlier in the cooking process because it takes a while for the dry herbs to incorporate their flavor into the sauce. But I would always recommend whenever possible to use fresh herbs, and you want to add those right at the end, about 5 minutes before you're going to finish the sauce and serve it. Now, classically, a cream sauce is going to be served with white flesh. So, any, you know, kind of a fish, you know, white poultry such as a chicken breast, you know, a pounded out veal breast, veal cutlet. You want to use something like that because, you know, a white sauce is a lot more subtle in flavor than a demi-glace or a brown sauce or a roasted stock-based sauce. So you want to make sure that you're using it with something that's going to be complementary. I would never put a cream sauce on a roasted piece of beef because the beef is going to overpower it, and cream sauce and beef is just, you know, it just doesn't really seem that appealing to me. Now, another secondary sauce is what's called sauce Mornay, and you're going to take the same base recipe that I laid out for you for the bechamel, and you're going to right at the end, you're going to stir in 4 ounces of grated Gruyere cheese, 2 ounces of Parmesan, and then you're going to turn off the heat, and you're going to whisk in 2 ounces of raw butter right before serving, and that butter is going to add a nice little, you know, buttery, fatty mouthfeel. And also at this point, too, because, you know, you have such heavy flavors in your Mornay sauce, the cheese and the milk and the butter, I would highly recommend either adding, you know, some sort of a fresh herb, which isn't classic, but you can do that, or at least a little bit of acid in the form of, you know, lemon juice is kind of like the go-to for these kind of sauces, especially back in Escoffier's time, or a nice vinegar. So whatever you want to do, just, you know, about a half a tablespoon will do the trick. And you're not looking to make your Mornay sauce taste like a cheese and lemon sauce. You're just going to add just enough acid as a seasoning to help kind of cut through some of those fattier mouthfeels. Now, you can also do a simple cheddar cheese sauce by taking the sauce bechamel recipe and stirring 8 ounces of cheddar cheese, about a half a teaspoon of dry mustard, and 2 tablespoons of Worcestershire sauce. And that'll give you a nice cheddar cheese sauce. And this is great over broccoli and all sorts of fun vegetables. Also, one of my favorite ways to use a bechamel as a base is a simple mustard sauce, which you're just going to finish off your bechamel. And right at the end, you're going to stir in 4 ounces of good Dijon mustard and finish with raw butter, again, off the heat. And this is actually one of my favorite sauces to do. You know, sometimes I'll make like crab cakes or salmon cakes. This little, you know, Dijon mustard sauce is really, really good on any sort of a fried fish, but especially for whatever reason in the cake form, it's really, really nice. So as you can see, with just that simple bechamel recipe, you have a multitude of secondary sauces. And again, feel free to use and doctor the sauce as you see fit. Just, you know, don't overthink it in your head. It's nothing more than a simply flavored, roux-thickened milk sauce. And from there, you can add any number of herbs and spices and whatever it is, you know, caramelized onions, caramelized shallots, roasted garlic, whatever it is that you want to add to this sauce, you can add it in right at the end and give it a nice, unique flavor that's all your own. So in today's question and comment segment, I have a question from Luke that it was extremely interesting. And Luke asks, or says, "Hey, Jacob, love the podcast. I've been with you for every episode. It really fills a void. As an amateur chef and professional scientist, I particularly like your discussion of food science. I have a question about episode 9. In the holidays section, you suggested that acidifying the egg yolks with vinegar reduction to prevent coagulation during the cooking process raises the denaturing temperature to 195 degrees, making the process more forgiving. Good enough. Then, in the egg poaching segment, you again suggested that the addition of the vinegar, this time to 180 degree water, to help the egg whites coagulate. What gives? Is the pH temperature denaturing relationship not consistent across proteins? Does the vinegar actually have the opposite effect on yolk and white? If this is true, is it possible to poach an egg in neutral solution? I realize that these are trivial to address empirically, but I'm interested in the culinary context for the answer. Thanks for the great podcast, Luke." Well, Luke, thanks for the great question. And, you know, to be completely honest with you, I didn't know this one off the top of my head. I was like, wow, that's quite the paradox. But I knew that there is some sort of paradox going on there because I've done both techniques. You know, obviously using acid in a poaching water for eggs, but also to adding the acid in my egg yolks for hollandaise. And I've seen how it affects the overall result. And I stand behind that. So I had to, you know, go through and bust out some of my food science books and do some research. And it was a lot of fun, actually, because basically what I came across is this sort of egg acid paradox. And so here's basically the rundown. Eggs begin as a liquid, since they're really nothing more than bags of water that have dispersed protein molecules in them. So for every one protein molecule in an egg, there is about 1,000 water molecules. Now, before we go any further, it's important to understand the nature of a protein molecule. In the raw, uncooked state, a protein molecule takes the form of a long chain that are basically rolled up into tiny little balls. Now, its compact shape is maintained by bonding with neighboring partners of its own chain. Now, heat, when added to a protein molecule, as I mentioned before in the previous podcast, is nothing more than a radar gun for molecular movement, right? So the faster the molecules are moving, the more heat that's present. So when you apply heat to an egg, what happens is all those protein molecules start moving around faster and faster, and they start knocking into each other, breaking the bonds that were holding them in their compact ball shape, allowing them to start to unravel. Now, when proteins start to unravel, this is called denaturing. So once these molecules get to start to stretch out, they find other protein molecules and start to bond with them, making up a sort of a three-dimensional protein network. Now, when this bonding starts to happen, this is what we call coagulation. Now, the reason why acid allows an egg to coagulate at a lower temperature and paradoxically keep it from coagulating at a higher temperature is due to the charge of the protein molecules. See, most proteins that are contained in a raw egg white are negatively charged, whereas in the yolks, some are negatively charged and some are bound up in fat protein packages. As anyone who has ever played with magnets knows, opposites attract, so two negatives will repel one another. Since the protein molecules are suspended in water, they create this sort of equidistance equilibrium, spacing themselves from one another. Now, the addition of acid, or anything acidic for that matter, will lower the pH of the egg, diminishing the effects of the protein's negative charge. Now, this allows the still balled up protein molecules in the egg white to move closer together, which will slightly coagulate the egg. But since the protein molecules are now closer together, it's going to take more heat to get those protein molecules moving fast enough to smash into one another so that they fully denature and thus coagulate the egg yolk. So in short, adding acid to your poached liquid allows protein molecules in the egg white to move closer together, keeping the egg white from simply dispersing out into the surrounding water. On the flip side, when making a hollandaise, the whole purpose of cooking your egg yolk over a water bath is to slightly thicken them in the first place before you start emulsifying in your clarified butter. The addition of the acid helps to slightly thicken the yolks by allowing the protein molecules to move closer together, but at the same time raise the temperature in which the yolk proteins completely denature and coagulate, which will ruin your hollandaise. pretty cool, huh? I learned a lot. So again, Luke, thank you so much for your question, and I hope that helped. Culinary quick tip, we're going to talk really fast on how to make your own homemade macaroni and cheese. Okay, it just seems simple because most macaroni and cheese, they have a cream based sauce or a cheese sauce that's based upon the bechamel recipe. And in this one, we're just going to simply use a mornay. Okay, and the mornay is what we discussed as a secondary cheese sauce using the Gruyere and the Parmesan in the techniques segment. So for every pound of elbow macaroni pasta, you'll need about 1/4 or 32 ounces of sauce mornay. Now, you can add any type of cheese you want to this mornay sauce. You don't have to use Gruyere or use Parmesan. A good place to start is cheddar, yellow or white, and mozzarella. Those are some nice cheeses that'll play really nicely with your macaroni. Now, if you want a little bit of a gourmet flair, you can try using goat cheese, Gruyere, Gouda, any number of nice aged cheese that are going to give you more depth of flavor. Now, the basic ratio for macaroni and cheese is 1 pound of pasta to 1/4 bechamel. That's it. Pretty simple, huh? Now, it just so happens that the mornay recipe we talked about in the technique segment will yield 1 quart or 32 ounces. So this is basically going to be your base recipe that you can scale up and down for, making a pound of pasta's worth of macaroni and cheese. So the way that I like to do this is I like to have, some extra cheese setting aside because I like my macaroni and cheese extra cheesy. So you're just very simply going to take your cooked pasta. Usually you're going to use elbow macaroni, but you can use whatever you want. You can use the little spirally guys or the bow tie or whatever it is. I generally like to use elbow macaroni. I'm going to place it in a mixing bowl, and you're going to toss it with your sauce mornay and make sure it's evenly coated. Now, from here, you can doctor it up a little bit, add some flavor. You can add some fresh herbs, paprika, a little bit of mustard, some hot sauce, whatever it is that you want to start to, throw in there to make it more unique for your palate. And you're going to toss it around, and you're just going to basically lay this into an appropriate size casserole dish that's been, lined really well with butter. You're just going to, spread the butter around the casserole dish, and that's going to help it from, keep it from sticking. Now, during the tossing process, even though you already have that nice mornay sauce in there that has the cheese flavor, I like to add more cheese. And you can add, you want to grate it so that way it melts easier. But I'm going to add anywhere from 6 to 8 ounces of cheese, maybe even more, during the tossing process and, put that whole mixture into the buttered casserole dish. And then you're going to want about another 6 to 8 ounces for topping, so you have that nice cheesy sort of casserole-y macaroni and cheese. Now, from there, once you have everything in place and you have the cheese layered on top, it's always nice to finish with a nice crispy texture. Now, one of the ways you can do this is by topping with breadcrumbs. Now, if you are going to use breadcrumbs, I actually prefer panko just because they're a little bit lighter. And you can toss the panko in a little bit of melted butter. And this is going to allow them to brown better. And you just basically pack that on top. Another cool little thing, though, too, I've heard of people using saltine crackers that they basically just, crumble up in their hand into loose pieces. And again, toss with a little bit of melted butter, place on top of the casserole dish. But either way, it doesn't really matter, whatever you prefer. And then you're going to bake it in a 350-degree oven or about, 175 degrees Celsius for 30 minutes or until it is a nice golden brown and it's bubbling and oozing with cheese. From there, you want to let it cool slightly but not too much and serve immediately. And again, that's just a nice simple base recipe. So you can start using your mornay sauce and try out the bechamel technique. But, feel free to, again, make it your own and doctor any way you like. And that's Celsius for 30 minutes or until it is a nice golden brown and it's bubbling and oozing with cheese. From there, you want to let it cool slightly but not too much and serve immediately. And again, that's just a nice simple base recipe. So you can start using your mornay sauce and, try out the bechamel technique. But, feel free to, again, make it your own and doctor any way you like. And that's it for this episode of the Stella Culinary School Podcast. Thank you once again for joining me. Make sure you tune in next time when we continue our five-part series with part number 4 on sauce tomate. Questions or comments, head on over to the